Good afternoon, everyone. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is the Cook Inlet environment. I guess it's easy to think of our environment being the Chugach Mountains and the area surrounding, but really we're an ocean city. We get an awful lot from the inlet, including salmon and wildlife and oil and gas. It's the location of our large port, and it's also where we get rid of a lot of our pollution or waste. And in some ways, that's pretty unique. We have a sewage treatment system, which is a primary system, and that's pretty unique in the country. And we also have oil platforms that are allowed to discharge waste in the inlet. So the question is, what makes Cook Inlet so special? Why do we do that? Should we be doing it? Or maybe it doesn't do any harm and it's okay. And we're going to take on this topic with two sets of guests today. In the first half of the show, we're going to be talking about the Anchorage wastewater system and the disposal of our what goes down the drain. In the second half, we're going to be getting into discussion of the oil industry and the waste and hazards of oil pollution. So a big topic, and hopefully as listeners, you'll want to get involved and have questions. We will welcome your calls, and I'll give you the phone number and email in just a minute. First, I want to introduce my first guest and myself. I have with me Allie Harvey, who is the Sustainable Communities Coordinator for the Alaska Center for the Environment.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Brett Jokola, who is the Assistant General Manager at the Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. And my name is Charles Wolforth, and I am a freelance writer, journalist. I've written a lot of books about the environment, just to disclose in case anyone thinks I'm biased. I guess I am, but I'm going to certainly try to be disinterested. And I've actually given contributions to the Center for the Environment, in case people want to know that. So
Excellent.
If you think that I'm biased, you can certainly call me on it by calling our phone number. The number here is 550-8433. And outside of Anchorage, it's toll-free, 888-353-5752. You can send us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. And there's a ton of information on our topic at that website, kska.org. Scroll down a little bit to Hometown Alaska. Well, I just wanted to start our discussion with talking to Brett from the Water and Wastewater Utility about our wastewater system, which has some unique aspects, or at least unusual aspects, compared to other places. How do we handle our sewage, and where does it go, and before it goes into the ocean?
Well, that's a good question, and it's something that people don't usually think about because, one, it's not a very pleasant thought to
right.
wonder what happens after you flush your toilet, but most of our system is underground. The pipes are underground, and the discharge takes place away from where people live. So people don't think about waste discharge very often or wastewater treatment at all. But let me give you a little history. Prior to the 1970s, Anchorage had no wastewater treatment at all. We had a sewer system, and it's been continually expanded over the course of time. But until about 1972, there was no wastewater treatment system. And then
So the sewer system would just drain into the ocean?
That's right. Just outfall. In fact, there's a series of outfalls into the ocean. There's one down in Ocean View. There's one out in Turnagain. They were kind of distributed around the area. In 1972, through the efforts principally of Mayor John Asplund, the community decided that we needed to build a plant, and we used some construction funding from the Environmental Protection Agency to build our first wastewater plant. Hence that became known as the John M. Asplund Water Pollution Control Facility. And that's still the largest plant that we use in Anchorage, and it's been upgraded several times since then. In fact, over the past 10 years, to jump ahead a little bit, we've spent over $40 million in making improvements to the plant and making sure that the technology that we use is current and of the latest thinking.
So that's the plant that's out Point Warren's off near the airport.
Yeah, if you drive all the way out Northern Lights Boulevard to Point Warren's off, there's a plant just before you get to the barriers for the airport, immediately to your right, and that's where about 28 to 30 million gallons a day of wastewater throughout the community is treated and processed, and then disposed of through an 800 foot long pipe that goes out into the inlet right at Point Warren's off.
So it goes underwater, it gets under the mud flats, and comes out where there's always tide, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're lucky and you're flying in to Anchorage on a very low tide, you'll see clear water coming up near the edge of the water mud flats interface, and that clear water is actually the effluent from the wastewater plant, which is actually clearer than the water that exists in Cook Inlet, because the tides keep the silt from the glacial runoff in suspension. So there might be up 2,500 milligrams per liter of silt in the water column, whereas our discharge is in the tens to 20s to 30s kinds of milligrams per liter of suspended solids.
So tell me about the primary and secondary treatment, and then we'll let Allie get in here.
Yeah, the permitting of plants started in 1972 with the Clean Water Act. And through the course of the first 5 or 6 years, the federal government spent a lot of money building plants all across the country and did wonders of good for communities and wonders of good for waterways. In 1977, the Clean Water Act was amended, and a new section was added called 301H. And Section 301H modified the requirement for secondary treatment for plants that have certain conditions. One, it has to be a marine discharge. Two, it has to have very limited availability of industrial contaminants that come into the sewer and come into the sewage plant. And the receiving water environment has to be such that the waste can be rapidly assimilated. And there's a very rigorous monitoring program that's associated with the 301H provisions. And we've been monitoring the primary discharge from the plant into Cook Inlet for 25 years and continually through several different revisits of the permit authorization with the EPA. EPA has confirmed from our findings that the Cook Inlet continues to maintain a balanced indigenous population of marine biota, despite the fact that we're discharging waste. There's no sediment accumulation like there is around some outfalls that don't have the tidal energy. There's no evidence of bioaccumulation of toxics in critters around the inlet. And the water quality itself, we measure water quality annually around the outfall and following where the discharge goes, as well as in a control environment across the inlet, and we find that there's no perceptible change in marine water quality based on a discharge. So we're pretty confident that we have a good system.
All right. So now I'd like to turn this. That was Brett Jokola with the Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility. Now I'd like to turn to Allie Harvey, who's the Sustainable Communities Coordinator at Center for the Environment. You have concerns about the plant. Tell us what you would like to see out there and why.
Well, thanks. Clearly, we all care about the health of the inlet, and clearly, we have very qualified people working out in the wastewater utility. And we've actually had the pleasure of working with Brett several times, and have really appreciated the opportunity to tour the facility, to have lunch, to ask questions. So it's very open dialogue, and you know, the cleanest water that we can have in the inlet is what we're all working towards. That said, you know, we do have concerns given that we are so reliant on the inlet for so many competing uses, you know, including, you know, oil and gas development, recreation, tourism, subsistence, you name it. And when you think about what the cumulative effect of putting our wastewater effluent into the inlet over time will be, and you want to get some data as to what's going to happen to all that effluent, where it goes and what the impacts are to fish and thereby humans, we don't have any data on that. So our concerns are that we don't really have the research to show what's happening to that wastewater when it builds up over time and what that's going to mean for our kids and our grandkids.
Well, tell me, what makes this different from any other place? We hear about primary, secondary treatment. I mean, why is primary treatment not good enough, or what would secondary treatment give us from your point of view that we're not getting now?
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the, you know, and we've struggled a lot with, well, if this is not the answer, then what is the answer? And that's something that has to be a community-wide dialogue. We don't have all the answers. That said, as I'm sure Brett can tell you more about, you know, the primary facility that is there is, quote, an advanced primary facility, which means that they're using polymer to essentially kind of thicken out the sludge and take more water out that, which would be treatable and also, you know, lessen the energy costs of incinerating that leftover sludge. And that you can make the argument that that's better and that that's closer to secondary. But there's a history of the EPA not re-granting this permit that Brett was also talking about to other places that have had this advanced treatment facility, such as in Boston, where the EPA said, you know, in the 1980s, you can't have this permit anymore. The polymer treatment is not enough. It's not removing enough of the organics or the toxics or anything like that. So to get back to your original question, you know, what are we moving towards? That's a great question, and one that we hope to continue this dialogue with the utility and with, you know, stakeholders community-wide.
But in any event, you're at this point not satisfied with the level treatment, or do you just think that we need to know more about it?
I think that there's so many unknowns that we need to investigate those and work towards a better solution.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go to a caller now. Stu has been waiting, and you had something you wanted to say, Stu?
Yeah. Declining beluga, smoking gun. People have talked about the sewage plant, but the evidence isn't there. But observations that I've made, its invasive pike probably has a big influence on the lack of salmon, which influences the declining beluga. And I believe at least some of the natives over in Tyonek agree. If you spent any time on Alexander Creek on the west side of the Big Sioux or Fish Creek coming into Flathorn Lake, large salmon runs that were there 20 years ago are completely decimated. Invasive pike are now in the Little Sioux also, and set netters, unfortunately, are catching live pike in the inlet, which means every creek and river that drains into Cook Inlet may eventually have invasive pike. The effect of this on the beluga is going to be very detrimental. I've advocated that we need to find a way to reintroduce salmon, whether it means manually transplanting fry down creeks to reintroduce salmon to their lost range, or what. I think we need to look at the pike problem to figure out what's going wrong with the beluga. And as time goes on, check out the sewage problem, too. But mm-hmm. pike is the big issue right now, I think.
Interesting point. I hadn't heard that one. I'd like to go to Brett. And I guess what I would say is it's such a complicated ecosystem. There's so many inputs. Do we have a situation, like Ali says, where we really need a lot more research to know what's going on and what we need to be doing?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And we're working to aid in that regard where we can. I've spent the last 2 days talking with federal agencies about belugas, and we're working as part of the recovery team for beluga whales through the auspices of the National Marine Fisheries Service. Yesterday, we talked to some of the scientists that are working on the recovery plan, as well as the recovery team, and which is composed of stakeholders from around the inlet. And there's a lot of science, a lot of information that exists out there, a lot of stuff that has to be waded through to try and put the pieces together, but there's so much that we don't know. And one of the things that the utility has been really active in is that despite the fact that we've been doing all this monitoring, we're not satisfied with where we stand on our level of knowledge about the disposition of our discharge. So we have gone ahead and volunteered to do some mathematical modeling of Upper Cook Inlet. We've looked at the potential for accumulation of waste discharge throughout the inlet, and we're moving ahead with sampling of the discharge for some of the unregulated contaminants that could be of concern to the belugas and to marine biota. Mm-hmm. But the caller's absolutely right. There's a lot that we need to know about not only the whales themselves and where they live and how they grow and how old they are before they reproduce and where they eat and what conditions are like around their feeding places to make sure that they have the best access to foods, but also the prey, too. So we're concerned mm-hmm. about the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. I guess just any listeners who don't know, we used to have more belugas than we have now. I don't know the exact numbers in the past, but the numbers declined rapidly. Seems to be mostly blamed on excessive hunting. That hunt, at least the legal hunt, has been halted, but the numbers haven't come back the way people would have liked, and I guess we only have about 300 of these genetically apparently unique animals in Cook Inlet. Ali Harvey from the Center for the Environment, do you feel that there is a likelihood that the wastewater system or our sewage system in Anchorage is affecting the beluga? Do you think there's enough evidence to know? And if so, how would it affect them? I mean, just if there's I think of this bacteria and stuff we wouldn't want to think about sort of floating around out there. How would that affect a beluga, in your opinion, or have you looked at that?
That's a great question. Alaska Center for the Environment has been highly supportive of the research the National Marine Fisheries Service has done to recently, especially establish the 3,000-square-mile critical habitat for the cook and the beluga. It's, you know, I'm not a scientist, but it's based on their science, and we're highly supportive of that. That said, as far as what the specific effects of the wastewater treatment would be on the Cook Inlet beluga, certainly the Cook Inlet beluga is seen as an indicator species, which means that, you know, whatever it's undergoing can be an indication as to how other species that live in the Cook Inlet marine environment are going to bode in this environment. So if their numbers aren't bounding back as quickly as nymphs and the rest of us would like to, then that's kind of a call to action for the rest of us to say, okay, there's something going on in the inlet. There's many, you know, point sources of discharge, as we've talked about, and maybe we should start to look at, you know, what choices we make, especially as a growing city in a pristine environment, that will, you know, have effects on the marine wildlife and then eventually on human development here along the inlet.
But how do we, I mean, obviously some of these changes, if we made them, would be very expensive. And what if the caller, Stu, was right, and really it's a matter of these introduced pike and has nothing to do with the wastewater system? I mean, how do we, in your view, how do we balance those things? Or do we just say precautionarily we ought to do everything we can?
Well, I mean, the precautionary principle is certainly important because, you know, we want to make sure that we do the best that we can now so that in years to come there's not any unforeseen negative circumstances that we have to have our kids and grandkids contending with. And as far as, you know, the upfront costs of, say, you know, improving the wastewater treatment facility, there's some federal money available for that. There could be state funding available for that. And in other places, they've actually managed to upgrade facilities at a reduced cost to the ratepayer, just to directly address that. And, you know, if it's a matter of the pike, that might be, you know, look for creative ways to address that.
Yeah. Well, rarely are these things caused by one thing, I guess. It's often a combination. Our topic today on Hometown Alaska is Cook Inlet, the environment in Cook Inlet. This half hour, we're talking about Anchorage's wastewater system, which more commonly known as sewage, the stuff you flush or it goes down your drain. And are we treating that as much as we should? Are there changes we should be made? And what are we putting down the drain? Sort of a related issue to that is our stormwater, which, of course, is running off our streets and I guess is not really treated before it goes in, but I can be corrected on that if I'm wrong. In any event, if you want to get in on this topic, the phone number here is 550-8433, and the out-of-town number is 888-353-5752. Of course, we're on the air live at 2 p.m. If you're listening at 10 p.m., it's a rebroadcast, so don't call in. We also take emails at hometownalaska@kska.org. And the issue of cost, obviously, is a big one. How do we decide, or is it decided for us, really, if we have to invest in a better system or a secondary treatment? Is that something the EPA decides, and how does that come about?
Well, we have a permit, as I mentioned, from EPA under the Clean Water Act, and the permit has these provisions for treatment and some expectations for treatment. The primary treatment is a treatment based on sedimentation, stuff that is carried by sewage flow can either settle out or float to the surface, and then the treatment in the primary clarifiers scrapes the surface of the clarifier and scrapes the bottom of the clarifier, and that becomes the sludge that is treated with the polymers and ultimately incinerated. The stuff that doesn't float or sink travels on out and gets chlorinated for discharge. A secondary treatment process would involve a level of biological treatment, which would entail a culture of microorganisms, protozoans and bacteria and other little critters that you can't see with the naked eye. And that stuff is encouraged to grow in a vessel with oxygen and with the right growing conditions. And that serves to digest further the organic matter that comes in the sewage. Now, one of the issues with the secondary treatment, though, is that science isn't very well developed on how it deals with some of these unregulated contaminants. So if there are things like pharmaceuticals or personal care products that somehow We don't even know how far they get through the primary treatment process. They may settle out entirely, and we might be done. But similarly, we don't know very much about how well the secondary treatment process approaches that as well. So if we did expand to a secondary plant at the cost of $500 million in rough terms, the effect might not be may or may not be useful in terms of getting at some of these contaminants that may be of concern down the line someplace.
So if the issue were like some biologically active agent, like you know, birth control pills or whatever that's coming through people's bodies, and that's affecting the biota, you don't really know if secondary treatment would fix it.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. So instead of $500 million, it might be tertiary treatment or some higher level yet, which we haven't begun to project what the cost of that might be.
I'd like to go to Liz, who has called in. Now, Liz, did you have a comment on the EPA permits?
I did. I had a couple questions. One, if either of the speakers could speak to opportunities for public participation in that whole waiver process, and also to highlight with regard to some of the secondary treatment, it does offer a chance for some biological degradation of some of these compounds, and we do have quite a bit of study data supporting that. We do still have quite a few pharmaceuticals and personal care products, or PPCPs, that do actually make it through the effluent, into the effluent, even after secondary, but less so than after primary treatment. But my main question was about the waiver. So if we could talk about that, that would be great.
So the waiver you're talking about is the waiver that allows us to get by with only primary treatment, and we have to have that updated periodically, and you're asking how people could get involved in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to take that, Ellie?
Sure.
You're looking interested in that topic.
I can help you out on that one.
I figured.
I've heard that the waiver is likely going to be reissued by the Environmental Protection Agency either late in the summer and the early fall. And it's a great opportunity to get involved and kind of weigh in on what your thoughts are on the wastewater treatment. And there will be an opportunity after they reissue the draft waiver for public comment. And at that point, I know that I will be definitely standing by and watching and getting in touch with anybody who's interested to let them know that that opportunity has come up. So any callers out there who are interested in getting involved in that would be welcome to visit our website, which is akcenter.org, and or you can come to the Anchorage Waterways Council Creek Cleanup Day on May 8th and come and find an ACE staff person who will be happy to put your name down and get in touch with you when that time rolls around.
And we have that link is on kska.org, as well as links to all of our guests today and some other just background information for people who want to learn more. So kska.org will get you there everywhere else you want to go.
While we're talking about background information and links, I better make a pitch for www.awwu.biz, and you can find all of our permit information and all of our most recent monitoring information on Cook Inlet and our discharge at awwu.biz/EINFO, e-info.
Yeah, and we've actually got that one linked on our site, too.
Oh, cool.
So you're covered. Here's an email question, which is probably for you, Brett. The listener says, I think we need to be planning for the day when regulations will be tougher or when we will need a new permit. Are we planning for this financial hit today? In other words, aside from the environmental issue, we don't want to be flat-footed and suddenly have to pay out $1 billion or something like your half a billion that you're talking about. Is there any preparation for that kind of eventuality, or how is that handled?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, we're regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We're one of the few public utilities or municipally owned utilities that have such regulation. Many of our cohorts in the lower 48 don't fall under state regulation, but just have the regulation through their municipal ownership. In our case, the Regulatory Commission is very particular about how you establish the rates, as they should be. However, it's a bit of an issue for us in terms of trying to put money away to save for a rainy day, so to speak, because they're looking at rates that can be charged to customers have to be based on proven costs. So we actually look back 2 years to our certified financial reports to determine what the costs are, and then assign what's called the you can modify the cost to a certain extent with costs that are known and measurable increases to those costs, and you can develop a rate structure to cover costs from 2 years ago plus known and measurable increases. But you can't say, Well, we'd like to develop a savings account for the future. Mm-hmm. That can't happen. So what we have to do, if we were to fund something like this ourselves, would be to sell bonds and then use that bonded indebtedness as a cost that can be recovered through rates.
I see. And now, a lot of our system, for example, the Eklutna water plant was built with state grants, and a lot of our system has been built with other grants. I'm sure a lot of sewage systems have been built with federal grants. Are those kinds of funds available to offset what the hit would be to ratepayers?
Generally not. Much of the first push for water quality improvements around the country were developed by the Clean Water Act in 1972, which had this funding attached to it. That funding has gone away. And there was some very limited amount of funding in the TARA bill last year that provided.
It was a stimulus.
A stimulus bill. Mm-hmm. It provided some funding for projects that were shovel ready, so to speak. And the state got some of that money, and some of that money goes into the state revolving fund, which is it occurs in every state.
Mm-hmm.
Allows loans to be made from the state's fund to individual communities, and the state pays the fund back, mm-hmm. so that the fund revolves and can continue to fund improvements in the future.
I see.
But again, that's still bonded indebtedness. It's not grant money from
the It would raise rates substantially.
Yeah.
It's the short answer. Yeah. I have another email question here, which I'd like to pass over to you, Ellie. And this is a little bit off our topic, so if you don't know the answer, don't feel embarrassed. Emailer is interested in the runoff from the airport. There's a large amount of de-icing fluid that's used at the airport that eventually runs off, like all of our surface water, I guess, into the inlet. And I don't know. Are you aware of how that's treated and if that's adequate?
I'm not very familiar with this issue. I've heard mm-hmm. of the de-icing issue, and I've heard that even there was talk of having a different plant at the airport to treat that de-icer runoff. But that's the most that I
All right. Sorry, maybe you know more about that, Brad. I don't know.
Well, one of the difficulties with the airport runoff is that it's not a steady state discharge. It occurs only when there's a need to use the de-icing, and then only when there's runoff. So you have to be able to if there was to be a system to treat it, you have to have a system that can contain or deal with these large pulses of high loadings over short periods of time, and that mm-hmm. we haven't found a way to deal with that effectively as an industry.
Yeah, I guess that brings we haven't really talked about the issue of storm drains, which are obviously all over Anchorage, and oil drips off of our cars and runs into the storm drains, and people wash their cars and we have creek cleanup, and we have sort of awareness. A few years ago, there were painting fish on the storm drains to remind people that it does go into our creeks. Is this an area where we really need to be building some kind of a treatment system? And I guess either of my guests, is this something that is sort of another sort of issue that's on the horizon, or is it just something that people aren't thinking too much about? Brett?
Anchorage has had some experience experimenting with treatment. There are several of our larger storm drain systems that have impoundments at the bottom, some intended to be impoundments and some that are natural impoundments, like Westchester Lagoon has been filling in over the course of years with sediment that's run off from parking lots and a variety of landforms down into Chester Creek over the course of the years. But there are other instances at the end of storm drains where the municipality has constructed sediment basins and oil and grit separators that provide some treatment for that stormwater runoff.
Mm-hmm.
However, those have not been funded very recently, so we don't have a lot of that work in place right now.
Well, Ellie, did you have something to add?
Yeah, very quickly. I think that this goes back to the earlier point that you made at the beginning of the show, that people don't really think about sometimes the fact that we do live in a coastal community and that everybody's living in a watershed. So everybody has a creek that they're associated with, and what they do is associated with that, you know, their runoff is going to go to and then eventually go out into the inlet. And there's a lot that, you know, before we even think about wastewater, our water, we get it, we use it, and then what happens to it? There's a lot you can do at the consumer level to kind of reduce your impact on the water and thereby the creeks that we all use in the inlet, including, you know, very simple things like scooping up your dog waste. And as you were saying, like washing your car on your lawn and diverting your storm pipes and keeping your car in good repair so it's not leaking. So I just kind of, you know, if people out there are interested in how they can mitigate their impact before it even gets to the point of treatment, there's a lot of good information out there on that.
It's not all about the big money projects then, yeah.
You want to just keep in mind that not everybody can live upstream.
Yeah, that's right. or that nothing ever goes away, right? You know, it's always with us in some way, and we'd rather not be putting nasty stuff with our fish and the other stuff we eat. Well, I want to thank both of you. We're going to go on to another topic in just a minute here, but I wanted to thank my guests, Allie Harvey from the Alaska Center for the Environment and Brett Jokola from the Alaska Water and Wastewater Utility. You can look at their websites and learn more about their point of view, their ideas, and how to contact them at kska.org. And we will be back in just about a minute for another topic. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Charles.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is the Cook Inlet environment. We were talking in the last half hour about wastewater and better known as sewage and where it goes. We also get some really important stuff out of the inlet, including energy, oil and gas, the gas that heats our homes and oil that, I guess, pays some of our bills through our state coffers and employs people. And, of course, oil production has environmental impacts, and some of those have happened over the years in Cook Inlet in various ways, and I'm sure we'll get into some of them. When I was a much younger person, there was an oil spill in Cook Inlet when a tanker called the Glacier Bay spilled oil right in the middle of a red salmon run, and that kind of created awareness on my part that I lived here all my life, and I never really thought about that. So we've got two expert guests to talk about this today. In the studio with me is Jason Bruni, who is Executive Director of the Research Development Council. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone from Homer is Bob Shavelson, who is the Executive Director of the Cook Inlet Keeper. Bob?
Hi, Charles. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Bob.
Thanks much for being here. And as I mentioned in the previous half hour, I probably would be known as a greenie myself. I've written books about environmental issues, and I have supported Bob's organization. So if I seem biased, please call me on it and let me know, and I will try to not do that because we're trying to be disinterested here. So I thought maybe I'd start with you, Bob Shavelson, to frame what you feel are the significant issues in terms of Cook Inlet water quality related to the oil industry. Are we talking here today about threats, potentialities we want to avoid, like oil spills, or current things that are actually happening that we should be concerned with? I've certainly heard of discharges that are taking place, and I don't know if those are a concern or if those are still happening. So let us know what you think the big concerns are out there.
Thanks, Charles. Well, in a lot of ways, Cook Inlet really sits in a regulatory backwater compared to other regions of the United States. In Prince William Sound, for example, we just heard about the sewage discharges, and there's only a handful of facilities in the nation that are allowed to discharge under the secondary treatment level. Oil and gas is the only coastal area in the United States where you can discharge billions of gallons of toxic effluent into our fisheries every year. We've got thousands of toxic sites around the facility, around the watershed. You've got very lax standards for shipping. We don't have tug escorts, for example, like they do in Prince William Sound. There's a number of things that we can point to that show that Cook Inlet really is kind of in a time warp and that we don't have the level of safeguards that we find elsewhere.
I see. Well, Jason Bruni, Research Development Council, would you agree or disagree with that statement? Is the regulation adequate in Cook Inlet to your in your opinion?
Well, I think I'd absolutely put the regulation in Cook Inlet up against anywhere else in the world. I think that there's been studies that have shown that the discharges and what's appearing in the beluga whales and the fish with respect to cadmium or PCBs, mercury, other contaminant levels are the lowest, especially with beluga whales, in any stocks in the world. And, you know, the discharges that are occurring were approved by the EPA. They were approved by the state of Alaska. And so it's not like these things are happening in a regulatory vacuum. And those agencies wouldn't allow us to have any negative impact on the wildlife that's in Cook Inlet. So I absolutely would disagree with Bob on that.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. There's the two points of view that we're going to be talking with for the next half hour. And I want to get your point of view as well. So let me tell you how to get on the air with our guests. The phone number here is 550-8433. That's if you're in Anchorage. If you're outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. Call only if you're calling in the 2 o'clock hour, since that's when we're here. The 10 o'clock hour is a repeat. And the email here is ksga.org. That's sometimes the easiest way to get on the air. And hometownalaska@ksga.org is the whole email. ksga.org is our website where you can find links to the organizations and lots more resources. I guess let me go back to you, Bob Shavelson. The regulation is sort of for a means to an end, right? And the end is a clean environment. Do you feel that there's actual harm happening from these discharges you're talking about that you can point to, or is, as Jason said, you know, are we arguing about whether regulations are good enough, or are we arguing about actual harm that's taking place?
That's a complex question, because showing cause and effect harm is virtually impossible. And, you know, there's nothing that's been better studied than the human body, for example. Yet we don't even know why people sleep, for example. So to try to suggest that we're going to be able to show where a molecule of oil and gas discharge comes from a platform and gets into a fish a couple miles away, that's the type of regulatory box that industry has put us in. And I want to address a comment that Jason made, the suggestion that these federal and state agencies wouldn't allow harm to occur, I think is at best naive, because we recognize that these agencies are under intense political pressure. And while there's great people staffing these agencies, these political decisions manifest themselves in projects, for example, the Port of Anchorage. If you look at that, there's an expansion going on. They went forward with a design that would fill in roughly 135 acres of salmon and beluga whale habitat. Now, there was an alternative design to build a pile-supported structure, but Mr. Sheffield, the port director, thought that that would be too expensive. All the federal agencies agreed that that was the preferred design, but Bill Sheffield uses political influence to ram through this project without even a basic environmental impact statement. So, to suggest that the agencies provide a safeguard, they can up to a point, but when push comes to shove, the political powers and the money will always win.
Okay. Well, Jason, are you in the position of saying trust the government? Because that's not a real popular thing right now. Take on what Bob had to say.
Absolutely. And, you know, frankly, I'd put, as I've said many times on the record before, I'd put our system up against anywhere in the world. So if we choose not to develop natural resources here in Cook Inlet, they are going to be developed elsewhere around the world in places that don't have the same environmental oversight, that don't care about what's going on. So, you know, to say that there's political influence or political pressures, of course, I think, you know, it would be naive to say that there isn't. However, you know, you have to take into account cost and common sense. And, you know, I don't know the specific example with the port, putting it on pile-supported structures, but I know that there are other pile-supported structures that people are opposing, such as the Kinnick Arm Bridge right now. That would be on, you know, piles going across the inlet, and they're saying that that could have a negative impact on beluga passage, which there's been documentation of belugas going underneath the Placer River, and that, you know, we all know how low that bridge is. So, you know, it seems like we pick and choose when it's appropriate to you know, to debate which things are politically influenced and which things are good for the belugas or the environment. But, you know, Bob and I have a history of disagreeing on our statements.
Yeah.
Still a good friend of mine, and we both have, you know, frankly, young kids, and we both, you know, want them to be able to enjoy Cook Inlet. And I don't think either one of us would disagree that we want to keep the integrity of Cook Inlet and the wildlife that call that home as great as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let me bring this down to a particular. Bob, you mentioned waste from oil platforms. What is that issue exactly? What kind of waste are you talking about, and what kind of harm are you concerned from that discharge?
Well, let me take a step back. And the oil Cook Inlet was the start for commercial oil and gas development in the late 60s and the 70s, and the platforms went offshore into the waters of Cook Inlet. And a lot of that development predated our major federal environmental laws, in particular the Clean Water Act, which was passed by Congress in 1972. And so that mentality, that kind of frontier mentality, has kind of persisted. And the operators in Cook Inlet have successfully been able to argue that they should not have to abide by rules that apply everywhere else in the country in the coastal zone. And by the coastal zone, I mean within 3 miles of the coast, where the best available technology has been identified to re-inject these toxic wastes back into the formation from which they came. So when I'm talking about waste streams, we're talking about the oily produced water that comes up from the reservoir. The oil gets stripped out, and the oily residue gets discharged back in. Muds and cuttings that come from the drilling operation, those are discharged. And, you know, Jason will make the argument that there's been no harm identified in that, but it's kind of like arguing a negative, because there's really been almost no research put into looking at the ambient effects of these discharges on the fish and other resources in Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let me turn that to you, Jason. I remember being in the village of Port Graham, and the chief there, I'm embarrassed his name has suddenly gone out of my mind, but
Pat Norman.
Right, Patrick Norman, saying, you know, well, we're eating the food out of this inlet, and those guys are dumping that stuff into the inlet. Even if nobody can prove that it's causing harm, it sort of doesn't seem like we ought to be cleaning it up as much as anybody else is in other parts of the country, and that maybe that this is just simply not a good idea. You clean up your mess, in other words.
Well, I think it's important to remember this water is treated. It's not just dumped straight back in. It is treated water to the standards that EPA and the state of Alaska have established. You know, I think obviously Bob and I have are going to disagree to the level that it should be treated or is treated, but it absolutely is treated. And, you know, I think Bob and I would agree that new technology is absolutely important to try to get it to the highest standard that you're able to do to implement new technologies like directional drilling. I know Pioneer is trying to do some drilling offshore, but doing it through directional drilling onshore. Technologies like that can absolutely, I think, be agreed upon by both sides. Would you agree, Bob?
No, absolutely. And an example of Pioneer, I think, is an excellent. Pioneer is developing a field down here, the Cosmopolitan unit, just north of Anchor Point. And instead of having a platform in the halibut fishery offshore, they've incurred the extra cost to drill directionally from onshore. So we applaud that. But when we're talking about technology for waste disposal, reinjecting waste has been around for decades. It's not a new technology, and it's readily available for the Trading Bay facility here, where 95% of the discharges come from in Cook Inlet. And it's really just a matter of cost. And when you look at the operator there, Chevron, they're reaping windfall profits despite the economic recession. You know, and I just saw a prediction today that by the end of the year, people are predicting that oil is going to go into the triple digits again. So these companies have the financial wherewithal, but they make a decision, and it's a conscious business decision, because they have a fiduciary duty to maximize their profit for their shareholders, to push the cost to somebody else. And that's how you make more money, by not incurring the cost of proper waste treatment, and that's what we're seeing in Cook Inlet.
Well, Jason, turning to Jason Bruni, we have a field which is Cook Inlet is presumably declining, and we know the gas, we're running short of gas. Do you feel we have to make sacrifices in any sense because these are fields that are not at the top of their production, and sort of, you know, maybe there are some corners that have to be cut? Or do you feel like, yes, we should be doing the, you know, the best possible, you know, technology, or I don't know what the right word is. I'm sure there's terms of art. I mean, how do you feel about that? Are there current corners to be cut, or is it really just that a difference of opinion as to what's appropriate?
I think the latter is mm-hmm. the case. I don't think that any corner should be cut, and I don't think any corner is cut. You know, I think that there are choices that, you know, you're right. The amount of oil that we're having developed right now in Cook Inlet, it's down to about 14,000 barrels per day. That's really not that large. And, you know, at the same time, though, about 80% of our natural of our homes are the electricity comes from natural gas from Cook Inlet, as well as our homes are heated from natural gas. So if we choose to not have oil and gas exploration done responsibly in Cook Inlet, we're going to have to make other choices. Is that coal? Is that tidal? Is that wind energy? Each one of those has their environmental impacts as well on belugas, on fish, on development elsewhere around the world. So I think that there are choices that we can make. And, you know, I think it's important to think about that when you're saying, hey, we shouldn't have any development for oil and gas in Cook Inlet. We absolutely should. It should be done right. And I don't think corners are being cut.
I welcome listeners to get in on the debate here. These guys are really good talkers, but you know, no need to be intimidated. I'd love to hear some questions and some other points of view. Number here is 550-8433, and the email address is hometownalaska@ksKA.org. I'd like to get into the area of oil spill prevention. We just had the 21st anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which was obviously a epochal event in Alaska. People talked about us being prepared before that, and it turned out that we really weren't. After that, there was quite a bit of additional law and regulation that was put into place to prevent future spills, and it seems to be working in Prince William Sound. At least there have been a few close calls which have been averted that might really have been disastrous before those laws were put into effect. I guess just since we're going back and forth here, Bob Shavelson, are there some things that you see that need to be done for oil spill prevention in Cook Inlet that aren't being done? The Drift River Terminal with the volcano was one that I know you spoke out quite a bit about. Share with us any concerns you have on that topic.
Yeah, thank you. You know, when we started doing this work, our organization was formed in 1995. You know, we did an analysis on pipeline spills. There was roughly a spill a month from the pipelines in Cook Inlet, and we did a report with Lois Epstein, our engineer at the time, did an excellent report and highlighted these discharges. And just by bringing that negative attention to the matter, we've been able to get the industry to decrease those spills remarkably. So it can be done, but there really is a sense of complacency that I would characterize as the type that we experienced prior to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And you know, if you look at 2006, Tesoro had a tanker, the Seabulk Pride, that was ripped from its mooring up in Nikiski by ice and tides and deposited in the heart of our salmon fisheries with roughly 5 million gallons of oil aboard. Now, we've known since 1994, when we got an expert in here, a Captain Dixon from Sullenvoe in the Shetland Islands, where they have similar facilities, who came in and said, this is the most dangerous docking facility we've ever found in the Western Hemisphere. So we knew that this was a high-risk area, but Tesoro did nothing to bring in a high-powered tug that year, even after that incident. It took the next year, 2007, same boat, same dock, almost the same day, and they parted lines. They didn't run aground, but it was another near miss. And so now we've got one high-powered tug in Cook Inlet, but we don't have the escorts that we find in Prince William Sound. So that's one great example where we're in this regulatory backwater that I mentioned before. But the Drift River Oil Terminal, to me, really was just this shining example of complacency in Cook Inlet. And for folks that are unfamiliar with this is the oil storage terminal at the base of Mount Redoubt. And when Mount Redoubt became active late last year, we started to ask Chevron how much oil is in these tanks. And they wouldn't tell us. And we asked why. And they said, oh, because of the Homeland Security Act. And we said, well, that's very peculiar because over in Prince William Sound, they announced the volumes of oil in their tanks every day. So the point is that we didn't even know how much oil was there. We later learned when the volcano erupted on March 22nd that it was 6 million gallons. And we also learned we don't have the spill response capacity in Cook Inlet to deal with a 6 million gallon spill. So those two examples, to me, highlight the fact that we really don't have the standards that we need to for shipping safety and spill prevention.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do we know if it's adequate? And I guess turning to Jason Bruni from the Research Development Council, I mean, from the point of view of the average listener, they hear what Bob just had to say, and they say, well, that doesn't sound like enough. That sounds like a serious problem. How does sort of the ordinary citizen get some confidence that these things are being taken care of adequately when we know that, you know, in the past sometimes they haven't been?
You know, I came up here to Alaska as a biologist right as the oil spill happened. So that's interestingly what brought me here, and did a lot of my work and undergrad and graduate work on the oil spills, worked at the Fish and Wildlife Service on sea otters. And I don't think any of us ever want to see the disaster that happened in Prince William Sound ever happen in any Alaskan waters or any waters around the world again. And so, you know, I think absolutely Bob and I agree that we should have the highest of standards as possible in Cook Inlet. Now, you know, he mentions that there's spills a month, you know, one spill a month. Well, my wife works for Alyeska Pipeline. I have to tell you, a spill to them is a quarter of a teaspoon. You know, so it depends on, you know, the quality that we have. You know, you so much as spill a drop and you have to report that, and that's counted as a spill. There is a bunch of oversight that's done to make sure not even a drop is spilled. Now, again, with respect to Drift River, not a drop of oil was spilled. They, because of Open 90 and because of the what happened with the Valdez oil spill, we had a unified command system that was set up that brought together all of the different regulatory bodies as well as Chevron and the operators in Cook Inlet, and they were talking to each other. That's fantastic. That did not happen during the Valdez oil spill. There was all sorts of miscommunication going on. At the end of the day, not a drop of oil was spilled to Drift River. I think that's a success story.
Was that, I mean, with the Exxon spill, there was certainly a unified command put in, you know, during the cleanup phase, but certainly while the spill was taking place, it was, you know,
absolutely.
No command.
Confusion.
Yeah. So, but Bob, were you satisfied with the command structure there at Drift River during the volcano incident?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to address this because I'd encourage anybody to go to our website at inletkeeper.org, and we put out a chronology of the events that unfolded there. And, you know, when you look at incident response, the most important thing is timeliness. And it took a full week to activate that incident command structure. So if that is acceptable to Jason and others, that's the way they can look at things. But we certainly didn't find it acceptable when this volcano was going off and there was an evacuated facility and there was 6 million gallons of oil perched above our fishery. Now, Jason's correct. No one got injured and no oil was spilled, and that's important. But there's vital lessons to be learned from this, and I think it was only by the breath of God that we did not see oil there with a slightly larger eruption that could have ruptured those tanks.
I'll agree completely that there were lessons learned, and hopefully we'll be able to make it better the next time.
All right. Well, let's move on to talking about the beluga whale. We talked a little bit in the last half hour about the fact that this population of belugas, I guess, is biologically distinct, is endangered because of probably excessive hunting that took place in the past, down to about 300 animals, and has not recovered, has stayed at a low level for reasons that are really unknown, whether there's illegal hunting taking place or if there's something about the habitat that's preventing their recovery. And I guess I turn to you, Jason Bruni, from the Research Development Council. What would you like to see done to remedy this? I've heard a lot of things from folks about what we shouldn't do, you know, that we shouldn't put in a new sewage treatment plant, which would be so costly. We shouldn't stop development of the port. We shouldn't stop development of the Kinnickarm Crossing. Do you have any ideas of what we should be doing to bring about a recovery of these animals?
You know, I'm involved. I'm on the stakeholder committee. Brett Jokola last half hour was mentioning that he's also on the recovery team stakeholder committee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the health of the beluga population is imperative to all of us. If you look at the science, again, I'm a biologist. You look from the last 4 years, we're seeing a growth in the population. There was a scientist that NIMS has cited that stated 5 to 7 years after the cause of the decline stopped, and that was the oversubsistence harvest of the 90s, we would begin to see growth. Guess what? We average a 4% growth per year since that time that they predicted. So what do we need to do? Frankly, I think we need to do more research on the belugas. A lot of my members are funding research on finding out more about them. What is the actual population? Where do they go in the winter? And we don't know the answers to those questions. And so, you know, right now, I think putting additional prohibitions or putting in additional requirements on industry when there has been nothing shown, and the agency themselves has said this, nothing shown that they've had any negative effect on the whales, I think it's that's inappropriate. I think that, you know, we've coexisted with the beluga whales for since statehood, and it wasn't until that overharvest of the 90s. We've stopped that. We'll continue to do things right in Cook Inlet, and I don't think we need to put any prohibitions in place.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bob Shavelson from Cook Inlet Keeper down there in Homer? What kinds of things would you like to see happen to bring back the beluga population, or do you think that we can sort of just wait for them to come back based on the as our other guest was saying?
Well, first, I just have to take issue with Jason's suggestion that the population is increasing since the cessation of the harvest. For example, in 2008, NIMS came up with an estimate of 375 whales, whereas this past year they estimated 321 whales. So there's a lot of variability in these. It's never going to be exact, but I think if you talk to any of the experts on this matter, they'll tell you that the whale is in serious trouble. And you know, again, look at all the scientific and that have come out here. You've got the World Conservation Union. They put this whale on its what they call their red list for critically endangered whales. The only category beyond that is extinct. The U.S. Marine Mammal Commission, who's been charged by Congress with overseeing marine mammal stocks in the nation, they've been vehemently in support of listing and protecting the whale under the Endangered Species Act for many years. The National Marine Fisheries Service, all their expert scientists. So there's a lot of strong science out there supporting this. And my disappointment has been this has not happened overnight. And I think Jason did frame the issue well. It's not about what caused the decline. I think we're aware of that. It's what is frustrating the rebound. And, you know, we've looked to industry for more than a decade to get involved. And in the past couple of years, we've seen some photo ID studies and things like that. But I think if there's really going to be a partnership, if there's really going to be an effort to protect this whale for future generations, we need to see a lot more support of the research, a lot more support of NIMS, and really seeing some projects on the ground that show that responsible development and whale survival will coexist.
I would also challenge the conservation community to fund some of that research as well. My members have funded over $10 million worth of research over the last decade on the belugas. And so I think it is important for us all to come together. We all want to see healthy beluga populations. We can agree to disagree on whether the population is growing or not. As a biologist, I feel it is, and there are other biologists who agree with me. So it is not unanimous that the population is not growing, Bob.
Well, I want to we're just about out of time here. I want to thank both of you. We also had an email from a listener who's interested in the Chewitna gold, Chewitna coal mine across the inlet and what impact that would have. I'm going to share that with both of our guests, that email, and also put it on the comment section on KSKA.org so you can get your comment after we're off the air. So my thanks to Bob Shavelson calling it from Homer. He's with Cook Inlet Keeper. Jason Bruni, Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. And my name is Charles Wolforth. You've been listening to Hometown Alaska. I want to thank Kristen Speck, who always does a great job in the booth, and Pat Yak, who is in charge of news and public affairs here. And we will be back next week. Thanks very much.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.